We are back with episode 8. Blake Rodriguez is joining us. Blake, for those who do not know him, specializes in working with some really tough cases, operating out of both Manhattan and Florida. I think training dogs in a place like Manhattan is really unique, especially because such a high percentage of dog owners live in apartment buildings. And in this episode, Blake gets into some of the unique strategies he has developed to work with reactive dogs who have to navigate hallways and elevators on a daily basis. We also discuss helping dogs with stranger danger and using engagement exercises to build trust, along with a whole lot more. There's a lot to dig into, so let's not waste any more time. Just like our relationships with other humans in our lives, our relationships with our dogs are dynamic and complex. I believe that in order for those relationships to flourish, or to find resolution when those relationships become strained, we must attend to them thoughtfully and with care. Welcome to the Consider the Dog podcast, created from archived recordings of live sessions where our members get to ask their most burning questions to some of the greatest practitioners of canine behavior. I'm your host, Tyler Muto. I hope you enjoy this episode. And remember, if you want to join the conversation live, you can visit us at ConsiderTheDog.com.
Okay. Hey, everybody. We are here with Blake Rodriguez today. He's joining us all the way from Florida. And Blake and I are both home with our families right now. My son's homesick, so I might have a couple of little disruptions, but he's six and he's usually pretty self-sufficient. But just sort of giving a heads up there. It's part of the times we live in with COVID. But welcome, Blake. We're super pumped to have you here, man.
Thank you for having me. I'm super excited to do this.
Awesome. Awesome. So yeah, you know, Blake's in New York City. His business is in New York City. He's got a home in Florida as well, but having started his company in New York City, that presents a lot of challenges, you know, raising dogs in that kind of environment, especially dealing with the same stuff that all of us dog trainers tend to deal with reactivity and fear and anxiety and aggression and barking. I think being in an environment like New York City just sort of compounds all of that and makes it so much more challenging. So I always like hearing Blake's perspective on those things, because I always feel when I talk to Blake, like, I'm lucky, you know, out here in Buffalo, we have a lot of space around us in comparison, and it definitely can make things a lot easier. So I'm really excited to see the questions that come in. You guys can feel free to be posting questions while we speak. Jake, who's our production guy, who's going to be keeping an eye on that question and comment thread and filtering through those for us. So, you know, don't hold back, ask as many questions as you want. I'm going to lead off with a question that came in previously on the Facebook group, and this one's from Dylan. And Dylan's just wondering, you know, what are some of your like core thoughts as far as dealing with reactive or aggressive dogs in the confines of apartment buildings where you've got elevators and stuff like that? You know, do you have any like go-to strategies for managing or, you know, correcting these kinds of issues? And I know that's sort of a big topic, but are there any sort of general themes that we can kind of look at here?
It's interesting because New York City is make or break it, you know, and there are times where when training, you want to work in ideal circumstances and you want to have enough time to kind of build certain things or get to a certain place and not rush into having certain conversations right away. The problem is that New York City doesn't really wait for you. And sometimes you need to have those conversations. I think the biggest thing for me is I try and go out of my way with certain dogs to avoid certain things as much as I can, just enough so that I can establish a relationship with them that kind of is fair with the things that must happen, with the things that must be forced. So the idea is really a lot of doing my best to get them to understand who I am, the dog, and really allowing a dog to see that, hey man, this is inevitable, this is going to happen, but I am going to look out for you. Like, we're doing this and I know it's not ideal and I know you might not like this, but this is how it's going to happen and I'm going to go out of my way to make sure that we do it where I can give you as much space as you need, as much this as you need, but like, you have to understand that when I'm saying we're doing this, I know it's tough, we're going to do this, but I got you. And that's kind of important to establish as much of that relationship as possible, because you're in such tight quarters when you're in elevators, you're in situations, you're on sidewalks, or maybe you can't walk into the street because there's heavy traffic. So you're in a little bit of a tighter bubble, if you will, and that pressure can be tough for dogs. So the idea is relationship is really everything, and whatever I can do to sort of speed things up and push the envelope with what structure is like inside, with after I exercise with my dogs, with what the walk is going to be like. It needs to be a little stricter. I'll give you an opportunity, but you have to learn how to do this. I just want a dog to understand that I'm going to give you your opportunity. And once they understand who I am, it usually tends to be easier for them to you can see it in their eyes. It's the weirdest thing where they kind of look like, oh, I really don't want to do this. Are you sure? And it's like, I know, dude, I got you. So a lot of it has to do with us as a handler and how the dog views us. So understanding how to claim responsibilities, understanding how to control space is a big one. Understanding how to have this understanding with your dog where you will handle things so that the dog doesn't feel the need to is a really, really big one. And creating as much of a bubble as possible and doing that in areas where you do have time and you do have space usually gives you a couple of like free passes in those less than ideal situations.
Like, you mentioned something there just a second ago. I just want to kind of follow up on or touch back on, and I forgot exactly how you worded it, even though it literally just happened 10 seconds ago. But you said something about like, you know, kind of showing the dog that you've got these things covered so they don't have to worry about it. And I was kind of thinking the whole time you were talking that when we talk about this idea of building a relationship first and wanting to kind of establish some amount of rapport, that, you know, that sort of needs to be like this qualified thing, because sometimes to, you know, the general population, when we say, you know, hey, we need to have a relationship, you know, that may just seem like we're talking about, you know, hey, I need this dog to like me, right? I want to hang out with this dog. I want to make sure the dog is comfortable around me. I'm going to give it some treats. I'm going to play with it. I'm going to be this kind of fun, likable person. But, and I only know this because you and I have spent so much time together, working together. But, you know, I think if I'm wrong here, you can correct me, but really what needs to take place is the part of the relationship, like you said, where it's, you know, I will take care of certain things. Yeah. I will make sure that your needs get met. If you need more space from another dog, if you're feeling uneasy about something, I'm going to make sure that that happens. Yeah. So that in times when maybe I can't make it perfect, that, that there's that sort of trust there to lean on. I mean, is that kind of what I'm hearing here?
100%. You need like a proven track record, if that makes sense. So that they're like, yeah, all right, I know this guy's got me. And the hard part is, I find that dogs can lack trust in us and lack trust in handlers when our track record in other easier situations are proving that we're not capable. It's really our job to prove that we're capable. And there's so many ways to do that in easier areas that allows a dog to go, okay, well, this is definitely not an easier area, but you've looked out for me here, here, and here. So let's give it a go, you know?
And I think that it's so important to understand, like, a dog can very much like you and love you, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they trust that you're going to be able to keep them safe or that you're going to make those really tough decisions in those difficult situations. I used to word it like with clients that I would work with. I used to say sometimes it's kind of like you have a bank account of trust and rapport, because every now and then I'd for instance, be working with a dog that maybe doesn't like people touching it, like strangers petting it. And I'd say, okay, you know, you need to be your dog's advocate. You need to prevent people from doing that. If somebody tries to reach out, you need to intervene and stop them. And then inevitably the question comes up, well, yeah, but what about the times where like somebody does need to touch the dog, like at the vet hospital?
Yeah.
And so the way I kind of word it, which I think is really similar to what you're saying here, is you've got this bank account, and every time you advocate for your dog and every time you make one of those decisions that keeps them safe in a tough situation, you're adding to that bank account. Yeah. And if you've got enough built up there, then when you do have to take your dog to the vet, for instance, and you have to say, listen, I know you don't like being touched, but I need you to trust me here. I need you to accept this. It's so much more likely that your dog will look at you and say, okay, like, I don't like this, but you haven't steered me wrong in the past. and you've got that to kind of lean on. So it's really interesting to hear that that's such a huge part of your strategy when you're dealing with this stuff in the city. And I can imagine it's probably harder even to build that rapport, because again, you've got to work on prevention as you're trying to do that. You know, it's got to be really tough.
It's tough. I really you know, we had this conversation with roles and what you represent. I don't remember if it was during one of our seminars that we taught a while back, but we usually would have these talks at the hotel after a day to see how everything went. And I remember talking about when we were children, and you said something along these lines, and I was like, wow, it's the same thing for my mom and dad. I mean, I grew up in New York City, and growing up, you know, in the late 80s, like early 90s, I was born in 86. As you start getting older, I remember walking in neighborhoods and feeling like I had a different role when I was walking, I don't know, past the construction site with my dad versus my mom, because stereotypically construction workers are like, they're dogs, you know what I mean? So like, my mom was a fox back in the day. And I remember, like, everyone knew my dad. So even if we walked in rough neighborhoods, like, he grew up playing sports, he was a correction officer, everyone knew my dad. We could never go on vacation without someone like bumping into him and knowing him. So when I was with my dad, I just felt safe. I could be in the hood and I just felt safe. I didn't have a job of doing anything. But when I walked with my mom, I remember, like, I have these visuals of passing by men and passing by construction sites. And the moment we would pass by, I would walk behind her just so that they wouldn't stare at her ass, because I felt like it was my job to protect her. And I loved them both equally, my mom and my dad, but I had a different responsibility with my mom versus with my dad. And I feel that dogs are really not that much different. You know, a lot of these dogs love us. And like you mentioned before, it's not about just the love. It's like, what's the role that I have with you versus with you? And what are you capable of doing in a moment of danger? And what do you need help with? And I find that a lot of times when you're dealing with reactivity, dogs, it's almost like they seem like, they feel like their owners need more help. And that's, a lot of that stuff is predicated on how we live with the dog. So we need to have that proven track record. And I can't stress that enough. One of the things that I look to do is I try to cross out like a checkpoint list. You know, I try to make sure, from a needs or met perspective, like, have I given you a form of like exercise that allows you to get to be a dog, that allows you to be drained, so that your outlet or your moment of exposure is not your sole outlet? So like, I'll do something. I'll might just be more than a walk. I might play with my dog. I might play tug with my dog, throw the ball for a dog, take him on like a nice hike. So I just know he's depleted. And it's usually so much easier to then put ourselves in a situation of exposure that we know is more challenging, because one, the dog is tired. Two, throughout that, I've advocated for you, I've given you space. And I just try to always look at those checkpoint lists. Three, through that, I've not only proven to you that I won't let anybody just reach in and touch you, I'll create a bubble, I'll do all these things. And that usually makes it easier for me to then take the next step of changing how a dog feels emotionally about something. Because there's so much involuntary like response with dogs when they feel some type of way. So I can't just always look to correct or punish certain things. There's some things that I have to, but once I've kind of put that flame out, I need to start contributing to how you feel about this situation. And if you trust me, if you know I'm not going to let anybody approach you and do all these things, now when the time comes that I go, hey, this person is going to approach and this is how we're going to do it, you can see the dog feel comfortable taking a back seat, knowing that I'm going to handle it. So all these things are so important, you know?
Yeah. And I think at its core, relationships are really all about, you know, how we make each other feel and how we 100%. Feel when we're around each other, you know? So Marcy has kind of a follow-up question to this. She says, you know, she understands all dogs are different, but generally, how long does it take the average dog to trust your relationship that much that, you know, they'll be able to follow your lead and take direction even when they're feeling unsure?
That's tough. I mean, we do boarding trains. A lot of times the sweet spot for us has been 6-week programs, and we've lengthened what is common. We do 4, 6, and 8, and 6 is our most popular. I want to say by usually, and you have to understand, we're doing this 24/7 with dogs that are at our facility and stuff and dogs that are living with us. So we're really investing a lot of time. You can get to a pretty good place within within 2 to 4 weeks, somewhere in there, where a dog's willing to try a little bit more. But it's really tough because every dog has a different starting point. You know what I mean? And it's like, It's like, what's your history? Is it just a matter of like, you have no faith in the human's ability to do something, and now you see me doing it and you go, oh, okay, well, this human's different? Or is it you're really fearful and shut down, and I haven't been able to even have certain conversations because you just don't trust me in general before we go out into the world? So it really depends on where our starting point is. But I would say somewhere within a week to a month, you usually are in a really good spot with a dog where they start having a solid idea about who you are and what life is like while with you.
And do you think it's different at all? Do you think it matters, the fact that like you and your team are starting with that dog with sort of a blank slate? Like, there's no pre-existing conceptions about who you are and what your relationship is. Do you think that it's different with somebody who they're working with their personal dog and there is that existing relationship, and the dog does have already an opinion about who this person is, and now we need to change that dog's opinion about who this person is?
There has to be, you know what I mean? I'm going to butcher how it says, but it has to do with trust. It's like, you know, building trust is not really that hard, but once you break it, it's hard to kind of come back out of that. And I feel like a lot of owners are starting a little bit more in like a hole than we are, because we're starting on level ground and some owners have to dig themselves out. So it might take a little bit of time.
Yeah.
If you're not rushing things and you're not trying to force your dog in situations like, how long is this going to take because I have to go on vacation or we're going to the Super Bowl party and I need my dog to be around 40 people. You know, if you're not trying to make that like the priority for why you're doing it, I think you'll be fine. And it allows you to be a little bit more fair to the dog and just work more at their pace. And that's sure. Super important to just understand the dog that's in front of you and what's the pace that that's going to allow them to thrive and be successful with you.
Cool. Awesome. All right. So let's move on a little bit. So let me see here what we got.
And for the record, guys, I don't even want to be here. Tyler told me that if I didn't do this, I was off of Consider the Dog. I didn't want that. I had a different shirt on. He said, put the Consider the Dog shirt on. Otherwise, like, you're off. So here I am.
I'm a bit of a bully. I've got I've got some muscle down there in Florida that I was going to deploy. So Mandy's saying, you know, again, realizing that all behavior cases are this sort of, it depends, right? That's the quintessential answer to all behavior questions. It depends. She's asking, you know, she'd love to hear about maybe a really, really difficult case, that you've had, and then maybe why you've approached it the way you did. Particularly if there's anything where like a case where like you couldn't even really touch or approach the dog. Now, I know if you want a few minutes to think about that, we could go to a different question. Cause I know that's sort of like at the moment, like pull a case out of your head, but if you had any recent ones, you know.
I think we can jump into now. And I love Mandy, right? By the way, I know she is. She actually spent a week with me with her dog, River, Vishla, and we just made some incredible progress, just kind of reaffirming and like reassuring some of the great things that she was already doing and just building upon that. And she's a dog nerd just like us, and she loves it. So I appreciate her being here and asking these questions. In my opinion, the thing that gets toughest, or the thing that is toughest for me and for a lot of people, is when you're dealing with some level of fear where the dog is so shut down that you can't find anything to like motivate or drive the dog in the beginning. Like, the dog doesn't want to eat by itself. It doesn't want to eat with you. The dog doesn't really have any prey drive. So you can't like grab something to play around with. The dog doesn't want to like play fetch, doesn't want to do this. And you trying to put a collar on and off the dog is really, really hard. I think that's where the first thing that I think about is, how can I make our daily routine as easy as possible and our conversations as easy as possible? Because everything's a conversation. And if I want to build a relationship, if I have to enter tougher conversations in the very beginning that kind of set this tone where, for example, you're coming out of a crate and I need to put a collar on you, or I need to put a leash on you or something. And I know that's going to be a whole song and dance that's going to result in me having to do more than I would like early on. What's going to allow me to avoid this until we're in a better spot. And sometimes it's as simple as like, man, I have to leave a leash on this dog, like for a while, because I'm not going to go in and try and do this. Like a leash is going to stay on this dog. I'm not going to mess around with the collar. I'm going to have something that is like safe on the dog that he can sleep with overnight. And little by little, we're going to figure out a routine where I'm going to be around his food. I'm going to try to use that as a resource. We are going to go for a walk. I'm going to give you as much length as you need. And just for me, the toughest stuff is when you can't find the drive, you can't find the motivation, and that needs time to build. During that period, how can I avoid harder conversations until I'm meaningful to you? And for me, that's a big one. I would imagine like Tyler and I have been friends for a while. If he had a really tough conversation or a tough decision that he had to make in his life, that if I weighed in on a family decision, he would maybe consider it more now that we've been friends. Even if it's like, I can't believe you just said that, like we've been friends for a while, he would consider it far more than he might if we just met or we only knew each other on like Facebook or like we've never met before. So it's like, I don't want to weigh in or have these conversations with a dog that has no idea who I am. That those are the toughest. It's like, you really have to be smart about saying, okay, everything's going to push this dog over threshold. Everything or anything is really going to be far too much for this dog. How can I do the least amount possible just to kind of build some type of rapport with this dog? I feel like heavy fear where a dog lacks any type of motivation to do anything with you, those can be the toughest because it requires time and patience. And as humans, we tend to not really be very patient individuals. We want quick results. We want something within a 1 hour session right away. And those can be the toughest for sure. Not sure if that's the question, but.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of those areas that I definitely don't envy you guys being in New York City. Cause you know, for us, obviously you've been to my training center, but we just had a dog and he was a huge Dogo Argentino, super sketchy dog. We put some video of him on Facebook. He's really fearful guy, pandemic puppy, you know, situation. And, you know, we get dogs like that in. And for us, we can just go in the kennel room, pop the kennel door open, open the door out to the yard, just let him walk out, let him do his thing. We kind of just like herd him back into his kennel, you know, without ever having to touch him or put too much pressure on him. And we can do that for, you know, several days. We don't have to put a leash on him for days. We can just let him exist around us. We can let him out of the kennel and just kind of wander around. You can't do that, man. Like you've got to potty the dogs at your place. You got to put them on a leash and take them out into Manhattan. That's a whole different ball game. So again, it's one of those areas where I feel like I almost feel like I'm cheating in comparison to what you've got to do.
More of an ideal situation. And that's the thing that gets hard sometimes because I watch and I nerd out on some things and I go, oh, that's a really cool approach. And that's this. And sometimes those things are for people that you're still in Buffalo. So you're still in more of like an urban environment. There's some things that I watch and it's like, I would never be able to do that. So you have to get really good at being considerate and avoiding conversations and giving the dog as much space as possible while pressuring the dog into things that, you know, like the pressure is unavoidable. So you have to, you're always walking on this thin line, you know?
Yeah, no, it's crazy. It's a good question. That's a really good question. Okay. Let's see here. So, I guess this kind of ties in well. So let's go here. Let's jump around a little bit. Sam is asking, you know, do you have any particular like core methods you use for dealing with stranger danger in the home, for especially right now with all these COVID pups that all of a sudden have strangers, you know, strangers are everywhere for them. You know, people come in the house and they excessively bark. And I know, just to give a quick plug, you do have, it's one of the first videos you put on Consider the Dog was a video about like a go say hi drill. And so that's on Consider the Dog. If you search for it, I think it's titled Go Say Hi, but you can also just pull up like just all of Blake's videos. And it's one of the first ones he ever posted, but that's definitely like a stranger danger drill. But you know, if you want to talk more, if you've been seeing this more lately, I know if you're like me, you know, I've evolved even just in the past year or two. So you might have stuff you're doing now that you haven't even put into video form yet.
Man, there's always so much stuff you're dabbling with. And then you want to perfect it before you get it out, but you want to get it out so that you're like, this stuff is helping and it's working with me. I want to, there's always stuff that we're messing around with. I think when it comes to stranger danger, again, just like with anything else, it has a lot to do with understanding where the dog is and what the dog needs at that moment. because there's some people that initially need to just control a situation of space because the dog is normally charging and doing those things. So we have to be able to kind of interrupt and override the dog's desire to charge the door and handle it. Like if I can control space and I can control the impulse and we can work on getting that first where it's like, look, this person's not going to address you. I'm not letting you address that person. And we have this, and it gets easier for a dog to kind of be in place and, or maybe not even in place. It's like, I don't even care if you're in place. As long as you're respecting this space, you can disappear into the rest of the house, or the rest of the apartment. If you want, just be respectful here. Once you sort of have that, then the idea is, okay, how can I nurture some level of, obviously you want to contribute to emotional change. We were talking about that before. So it's like, do you want to get the human involved? For me, the biggest thing is, who's the human that's coming in? Is it someone that can take direction? Because if it's a friend of mine that can take direction and can understand how I want to help this dog, then I'm going to use them. But if it's like a plumber who just has to get shit done and he's like, listen, I just want to fix this pipe over here. I don't want to like help you with your dog. Then I want to kind of allow my dog to understand that, like, look, this is the boundary. We're over here. Maybe I'm working with feeding the dog something. If I have a fun game with the dog, maybe the moment, and this is a really interesting concept I've been playing around with. If you can build some form of a game with the dog, like whatever it is that they absolutely love, and it depends on what the dog, you know, happens to love, but you find that activity and that's something that you guys do one or two times a day, or even if it's just once a day, and it gets so good that the dog becomes like neurotic and obsessive over it. What you can then do is you can start harnessing that and only using it when certain things happen. So you can essentially like counter condition it, right? The idea would be almost the same as muzzle conditioning. The problem with like muzzle conditioning is people tend to only put a muzzle on the dog when they need it. And when do they need it? You're going to the vet and you're going to get poked because you need your vaccinations and all this stuff. So the muzzle now represents going to the vet. And before you know it, you have a dog that is like, I'm not letting you put the muzzle on me. And it, we're the owners, we're the handlers. Now he's like, I'm not even letting you put it on because I know it means we're going to this vet. It's actually kind of easy if you have something that a dog loves. So the thing is, put the muzzle on first, right? The dog's going to hate it while it's on. Take him to his favorite place. Could be your backyard, could be the schoolyard. Sometimes we're using basketball courts in the city. Muzzle comes off. Play the dog's favorite game. Could be scent detection, could be fetch, could be tug, could be exploring. But the thing that the dog absolutely loves, could be working him for his food, whatever it is, that happens. And every single day you do the same thing. Forget the vet. Hold all vet visits. What's going to happen one day is muzzle comes on, dog hates it. We go to our spot, comes off, we play, right? Muzzle goes on, we go to this favorite spot, muzzle comes off, we play this game. There will be a moment where when you grab that muzzle inside the house, you see your dog start to anticipate. And all of a sudden in that moment, you go, oh my gosh, the muzzle now represents we're going to do this thing. We kind of almost want to take the same approach when the plumber comes over or when delivery comes over. And if I have to run up a larger tab for Seamless or whatever the food delivery spot is that thing's going to happen. And then we're going to play the dog's favorite game or we're going to do this thing so that it can hopefully start to take on an association just like the muzzle is. Whatever the dog knows least is going to come first in the sequence. It's going to represent what happens next. So as long as the plumber coming over, the seamless guy coming over doesn't result in him trying to be, I don't know, J-Jack calls it the man in the van, where it's like, hey, like I got some candy, kid, like come over here so you can reach and force a pet. As long as it's not a trap, that person or this experience can start to change and can start to represent something different for that dog. And you can do the same thing for food. Instead of the dog needing to approach the plumber, it could be something as simple as, hey man, just before you fix that pipe, here's some food. Can you just say, get it and throw the food, not closer to you, but like past you over there. And now a dog starts to represent, or a dog starts expecting that when people come over, he's going to throw that food. Now, maybe you have a dog that's still barking and we can address and have that conversation a little bit, but the bark is different because now it's a little bit of an excited bark, expecting that something's going to happen and the dog feels better about the person coming over instead of possibly thinking that every time the doorbell rings, I'm going to get stimmed with a remote or popped with a collar to go on place or do whatever and have the dog think that the only reason I'm feeling this is because of you coming over. If you never came over, I would never feel this. So just some things that we need to consider. A lot of it depends on where we are with the dog. Does the dog just need space first? Are we ready to start introducing and doing these things? Do we have a game or something that the dog really loves? If we don't, do we want to be building it around when the plumber or seamless guy comes over? Maybe we need to build it separately and then start to have these conversations. And prior to that, I'm just putting you away in the room, less than ideal, but it's what I need for right now. These are all the things that I try to think about when I'm working with the dog.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you say that. Sarah Bruski, during her live stream, which was in the beginning of February, she was talking a lot about using games to help get dogs who are unsure about new places. So like building up a game at home, getting that game, like you said, to the point where it's obsessive. And so there was a nice discussion there about that as well. And it reminded me actually just yesterday, I was on the phone with my wife's aunt and she just got a new puppy. And she's dealing with another pandemic puppy issue, which is that she's home with the dog all the time.
Yeah.
And she got this dog as a rescue. And this one's going to make this one's going to hurt you in your soul. But the rescue, like they gave her like a bunch of like literature of like, you know, best practices kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's in there is it actually says, don't crate the dog when you're home.
Jeez.
Don't crate the dog when you're home. So now she's in this situation where the dog has this, I don't think it's containment phobia or anxiety because the dog is crated actually overnight, but it's next to her bed. But the only other time other than overnight that she's crating the dog and being separated from the dog is when she's going to the grocery store, and she lives out in the country. So it's like a 2-hour trip to the grocery store. And not that it takes 2 hours to get there, but you know, door to door. Right. Mm-hmm. And when she goes, the dog freaks out in the kennel and she comes home and the dog's pooped all over the place and rolled around in it. And it's just been this big mess. And it was the same kind of thing. I was like, you know, you need to take advantage of when you are home to provide the experiences about the crate and help show the dog, what does the crate represent? You know, what are our expectations about the crate?
Yeah.
And you can start with it small. It can just be a 5-minute exposure and you can gradually build up to it and you can make it fun and you can use treats and you can do all these things rather than the only time you ever crate is you throw the dog in the crate and then gone, like off you are, you know? And I think it's those things are tricky. There's a lot of stuff coming up with the pandemic and pandemic puppies that I think makes owning a dog or getting a dog right now and providing the proper socialization and guidance really uniquely tricky in this time.
For sure.
So yeah.
Hey listeners, just a quick reminder, these podcasts are created from archived recordings of live sessions where members of our community can ask questions and interact with our instructors in real time. If you'd like to be part of the discussion, visit considerthedog.com and use code CTDPODCAST to get 50% off your first 3 months. That's 3 months for $10 a month, and you have access to not only these live sessions, but also our library of hundreds of exclusive videos and courses on dog behavior. Again, visit considerthedog.com and use code CTDPODCAST. Let's get back to the show.
Sage is asking, can you talk a little bit more about how you use engagement to build trust? Now, we might have kind of talked about that, I guess, in that last discussion. If there's anything you want to add to that, I guess, about using engagement. I mean, so I guess, you know, we were just talking about using it, like presumably the dog already trusts us and we build a game. We use that to build trust around new places or new people. Do you use engagement? Like you get a dog into your board and train and it's unsure about you. Do you use any sort of engagement activities to help shape how the dog feels about you?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Everything is about us and the environment and really a lot of how the dog feels about me, period. Because if you can feel phenomenal about me and then I can prove that it's not just that you love me, but like I can handle things you have less responsibility when you're with me, I think it's going to be great. So then the dog can really, it's an easier buy-in for the dog to want to engage with me instead of saying, I can't right now. I need to focus on everything else. So like ideally engagement over state of mind is something that I've been dabbling with a lot more. Actually, just on the quick tip topics and Consider the Dog spoke about this, and also spoke about like differential reinforcement and kind of using engagement and using certain things that are a little bit easier for the dog to kind of buy in. It's almost like crossing a bridge. There's some things that make it hard for a dog to kind of engage with you when something else is going on. It's almost like a longer bridge for them to cross. And that bridge is scary. If, I don't know, it's a 100-foot drop, you find yourself in a place where you have to get this dog to cross the bridge. What's the easiest way to do it? Can I make that bridge shorter, or can I keep that dog distracted while they're crossing? That's where differential reinforcement of alternative is kind of cool. And we speak about the game and doing something that is really like fun for the dog, or something that mimics or replicates what the dog wants to do. I've been dabbling with this a little bit more with some of the harder dogs. I spoke a little bit about it, and this stuff is a bit new to me as well, but the difference between differential reinforcement of alternative, incompatible, and other. And essentially with alternative, it closely replicates what the dog wanted to do anyway. So this is where I say, like, you don't always need to do this. And a lot of times you can just have a dog sit and down and ask them to do so with space, and it's easy for them to kind of not avoid, but observe something from a distance. For a dog that's really struggling, it's hard for you to ask for a sit or a down or a heel or eye contact in the face of like adversity, whether that's temptation or something like that, or a distraction when a dog wants to do something else. If it's a dog that's aggressive and wants to bite this other dog, it can be hard to tell it to sit or to down or to look at you. It's like, ah, man, I need to bite this dog over here. So what if we can use differential reinforcement of alternative, which is a close second that closely replicates and mimics what you wanted to do anyway? And the idea here is it's tough because most people view it as reinforcing the dog's desire to bite. Now, let's say I had this dog, he wanted to bite another dog, and I say basically, don't bite him, bite this instead. And I have this tug toy. Now the dog is shredding this. But what happened is when I said, hey man, you want to play this game really quick? And I turned it on. This is like the window series that I just posted on Consider the Dog. The dog is like, wait, what? I get to bite this? And it's not ideal. The dog might not want to engage with you, but he's like, it's kind of what I want to do anyway. And I know I'm not going to be able to do that because that leads to bad things. Maybe you punish that. And I don't like that, but I guess if I get to bite it, and I can take out my frustration on this other thing. Most people from the outside looking in look at it and go, you're just teaching that dog to bite in that moment. But something really interesting is happening. You're getting engagement that you otherwise wouldn't have gotten. Because the other outside of that, the dog would have blown you off. He would have continued to lunge or be reactive, or you could have told him to sit. He would have sat. He would have focused on this. He would have downed and still like gone bananas over that. But now you got him to essentially made something else more appealing, and you said, all right, forget this. And now you've created space, you've created a bubble, and you've done it in a fun way. It makes engaging with you just easier. It's easier to build trust. It's easier for a dog to go, okay, forget about this. And that's with differential reinforcement of alternative, because that incompatible, which is the obedience in that moment, didn't make sense for that dog. The other thing that doesn't get spoken about enough is differential reinforcement of other. Which is
I was going to ask you to like clarify what's the, because alternative and other almost sound like the same thing. So,
So differential reinforcement of alternative is basically, it closely mimics and replicates what the dog wanted to do anyway. And that could just be a heightened state. Like the dog was super excited and you go, hey, be super excited about this or whatever. Or you wanted to bite that. Hey, don't bite that, bite this. Don't hit him, hit this punching bag. Right. And from there we can teach, just like a kid that it's getting into fights in school and you enroll them in martial arts. And it's not so much that you're teaching them how to fight, which you are, you're building discipline. You're teaching them how to take direction. You're teaching them how to focus, and you're building all these life skills within that. Now, differential reinforcement of incompatible is your obedience. And sometimes that can be tough. You can get it with some dogs, but incompatible, it's so different from what the dog wanted to do that for some difficult dogs, it's a hard bridge to cross. It's a hard buy-in. It's like, oh, I don't really want to do that right now. And then the third is differential reinforcement of other. Now, other is us acknowledging anything other than their own choice. And I feel like this one doesn't get spoken about enough because, and I've made the mistake with this plenty of times in the past, where you have this perfect picture in mind of what you want it to look like when you pass by a dog or you pass by that scooter or skateboard or whatever it is, that you correct the lunging and the reactivity and the craziness, and it results in less than what the dog was doing before, some level of hesitation, but the dog is still getting worked up and has some perhaps emotional involuntary response. And then we go and we correct and we look to punish that without realizing that it was a dog that was showing hesitation that they never had before, that was starting the process of gravitating toward making another choice. And then we maybe shut that down. So now the dog is like, shit, this sucks. No matter what I do when I see the skateboard, this is going to suck. So with differential reinforcement of other, we had a dog that was flat out lunging, flat out being reactive, flat out being aggressive. We maybe put out that fire with some form of punishment or something, let's say. And now the dog is not doing that, but is still getting a little bit worked up. We might be in a place where we want to acknowledge that level of success. It's not perfection, but it's a step in the right direction. And just being able to provide that space, good job, that's pretty good, and start the process of allowing a dog to feel successful in a difficult situation can be a total game changer for a dog.
Yeah, I actually like that differential reinforcement of other. That's a big part of what I do. I just don't call it that. I mean, I remember reading about these different types of differential reinforcement in a textbook 10 years ago, and then promptly, like, it went out of my mind. But you know, the other kind of piece of that I think falls under that category is because, again, like, okay, let's say we have a dog who reacts when it sees a skateboarder, and then, we're so focused on that. And maybe we often try to get a different behavior, like maybe recalling the dog in the opposite direction, for instance, right? And so if it reacts, we go, okay, don't do that, and we correct. And if we say come and it comes to us, we go, yay, and we give it a treat. And then you get these moments, these passes in between where, like, a skateboarder is nearby or goes by and the dog just doesn't acknowledge it. And we often let those moments go by, and because we didn't ask the dog to do anything, the dog didn't actually do anything. And I'm always really big on kind of helping people to understand the value of reinforcing non-reactions. Like,
yes,
it doesn't matter what you did or didn't do, as long as you didn't do the one thing we're trying to stop.
Yeah.
You know, and if literally you just stood there with a blank look on your face, like, great, that's beautiful for me. I'm going to give you a reward. But we see it also a lot with, I think you kind of pointed to this with, like, you know, maybe you walk your dog on your left and then there's a skateboarder that's going to pass by on your left. And so the dog tries to cross over to your right. And if normally your rules about heel are like, you must be on the left. And when the dog tries to cross to the right, we correct them. And it's like, but that's the dog trying to make a new decision where they normally would make this really problematic decision. So I'm all about rewarding those moments. I could care less. I could always go, I mean, even if I cared about the dog being on my left, which I don't, I could always go back and fix that later. It's like, that's so easy to fix in comparison to the reactivity. So let's prioritize the reactivity and, like, let's not lose the forest for the trees, right? Like, the reactivity is this important thing. And because we end up nitpicking something else, we actually undermine what is actually our bigger goal. Or like another really good example of this is, I had a client a few weeks ago whose number one thing she needed was her dog to come when called. That was, like, the number one thing. And normally she'd say come and her dog would just blow her off. So we're sort of towards the tail end of training and, she's working on come, and she's not the kind of person that's going to be really strict with the dog. Like, she's not going for, like, perfect finishes in front and that kind of thing. She just wants the dog to come to her. And, you know, normally we teach dogs to come to us and stop and sit. And there was a repetition where her dog came to her and, like, came to a stop, wasn't, like, super close and didn't like sit on her own. And she was like, should I correct him for that? And I was like, well, no. I was like, you know, we've definitely taught him that he's supposed to do that, but, like, he came to you. He came to you and he stopped. And if you want him to sit, you can always encourage the sit. You can take a treat. You can use some verbal encouragement. You can just guide him into a sit gently with your hands. But what we don't want to happen is we get so bent out of shape about the sit and we correct the dog for not doing that. And the dog goes, hey, you said come, but when I came to you, I got punished. And so next time I'm going to be hesitant. And if we think about it, like, how much do we really care about the sit if the dog actually came to us and stopped? And she was so relieved to hear me say that, because other trainers she had worked with had like really stressed the importance of all that. And the reality is, she actually didn't care if her dog sat or not. She was over the moon that the dog stopped what he was doing, came to her, didn't blow past her, like stopped, had engagement, whatever. And it's just the same kind of thing, right? The alternative there is, you know, he didn't respond to the command come by ignoring us, right? Like he came to us. He didn't do a perfect come, but like he got the big picture. He got that number one goal. And I think that plays into a lot of this reactivity stuff and dealing with stranger danger and trying to get, you know, engagement with insecure dogs. And it's like, if your dog normally has a fear response and they don't, maybe they didn't do exactly what you asked them to, but they didn't have this like terrible fear response. Like let's celebrate those moments and really give a lot of encouragement there.
I think you hit on something really good just before that. And now that's beautiful too, like within itself, but you were talking about differential reinforcement of other. And I think the important thing to kind of point out is, for the most part, it's kind of like what we want. You know, like we could always be giving the dog direction. We could always be telling him what to do. But those moments where you say nothing and the dog makes a good choice, it's like, we should at least acknowledge those things, because you want to get to a point where you can live with your dog and do less and have them just make better decisions on their own. You know what I mean? And
exactly.
It's like, you get that. We just have to remember to acknowledge those moments, especially the ones where they may have leaned toward making wrong choices and now you see them making good ones. It's like, don't ignore, or don't just be in the business of only correcting the wrong. Acknowledge the right and acknowledge the better than before, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think the goal ultimately for most people is to have a dog that listens to obedience, but to not need to use obedience that much.
I agree.
You know what I mean? Yeah. All right. I think we have what time is it? Let's see here. We got time for one, maybe two more. So let's see here. Okay. So this is a good one. This one's from Maria. And she says she just moved to, I think Maria is her first name here. I apologize if that's not correct, but just moved to a new property on a hill with tons of gophers. And she's got a 4-year-old German Shepherd Husky. And the dog would spend the whole day stalking and pouncing on gophers if she didn't stop her. She said, can this be turned into some sort of game, like some sort of constructive game?
Yeah, I think so. I think ultimately, so there's different debate on this, and then people tend to want to use the word like suppression for everything. But I mean, like a lot of what we do are teaching a dog time and place, which is a form of like suppression. Like you can't, unless you live in the middle of nowhere, it's a little unrealistic to expect that you can let a dog do what it wants when it wants. So I think it's our job to be able to put limits on things, but do it in a way that is as fair as possible, that doesn't deprive the dog the opportunity to get to be a dog. So you can utilize the gophers, or you can, you know, get different flirt poles and different lures and all these things and start the process of utilizing windows, essentially, which is teaching time and place when and where, which is exactly what we do with our kids. You know, my daughter wants me to play tag with her and chase her all the time. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just, we can't do it all the time. Sometimes there's dogs around, sometimes there's people over, sometimes we're watching a movie, sometimes I'm cooking dinner. So as long as I go out of my way to kind of provide for her and give her exercise and do that, I tend to feel fair about shutting that down and then saying, okay, now we're going to chill and we're going to do that. And I think the window series that I put out on Consider the Dog is a really good way to start really just understanding time and place and compartmentalizing things in a way where it's a little bit clearer for a dog to understand when and where to do these things. So there should be moments where you can get your dog tired. You can do that thing. You can give the dog that outlet, whether it's for the real thing or the toy or what you're building. You might have to build this away from that area first, where your dog can get depleted. Your dog can have that fun, can really do that. And then we spend time chilling out in that enough window, or just sort of switching it up. I think it's super, super important. I wouldn't stop the dog from getting to do those things. I would just look to try and control it and let a dog understand that it can't be 24/7. So I think you can totally, definitely turn it into a game. It's just a matter of being smart about it and having the tools necessary that allow you to start the process of teaching a dog when and where. Because if you're asking for these things and you're not set up to get it, you can end up with a dog that just starts viewing you almost as the Charlie Brown teacher, and you're saying something, but they don't listen. You say this stuff all the time and they continue doing their thing. But I would definitely utilize it. I mean, it's probably easier for you, a little bit less work for you, maybe not in the beginning, but you have gophers, I think that's what you said it was, that you literally do not have to pay. You know what I mean? Like, you have free help. It's just a matter of finding out how to use that properly. And who knows, maybe you can treat them. I don't know. But like, you have workers that are working for you that you literally don't have to pay. Take advantage of it.
Just set up like a treat and train right outside the gopher hole with gophers eat in it. I don't know what gophers eat. Carrots, maybe? I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I think the key thing with play, right, is just remember, like, play is there to teach, right? Like, that's why animals play in nature. It teaches them life skills. So whatever game we're playing, we just want to make sure that we're using that game in a way that's going to help us rather than hurt us. I mean, I think that's kind of the big message. All right, there's a couple here that I want to get to. We did start a couple minutes late. So Blake, if it's cool with you, maybe we'll run a little, like, 5 minutes over. I'm going to end on, I guess, a little bit of a heavier question, but Gustavo is just asking, do you have any strategies for dealing with clients that maybe have, or just people in general? I mean, there might be, you know, people listening to this stream that are not, you know, not professionals that have some hesitation or negative preconception about certain dog training tools. So obviously, in particular, you know, I know we use, you know, remote collars a lot, prong collars, for instance. These might be things that many of our listeners see us using and are still a little bit unsure about that. So how do you help people understand the value of these things and help people to gain some level of comfort with it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, being able to articulate and explain things is something that I always try to work on, because I think for the most part, a lot of tools are just largely misunderstood in regards to how versatile they can be. People tend to think of tools as like a one way only, and it's only going to be used for this. It's only going to be used to tell the dog no. And I feel like you don't need to limit these tools to those things. So I really just try to compare it to other things. A lot of these tools are languages, and they're our voice, you know, so I can only use my voice just to yell at you and tell you no, and understand, you know, that I'm only going to use it when you're doing something wrong. But I can also use it to coach, to guide, and reinforce our behaviors. And a lot of what I try to do in my training is get a dog to understand that for the most part, they're in control. Like, you can control what you get and what you don't get, not only out of life, but especially from me. And that also means the side of me that you get and the side of me that you don't get. And it's exactly what we do with our kids. You know, you want to reward certain behaviors that are ideal and you want to see more of, because you want to reinforce and get more of that. But what people don't understand is that you can use these tools to reinforce as well. And the large bulk of what we do with any of these aversive pressure tools are going to be some form of negative reinforcement anyway. So once a dog understands that you're either dealing with pleasant or unpleasant, that's an easy way to kind of think about it. You, the dog, can do something that results in pleasant being added. You, the dog, can do something that results in pleasant being taken away. There's situations where we can dabble with that. We also want the dog to understand that they're in control of unpleasant as well. If I'm adding something unpleasant, it's not for no reason. I'm not crazy. You, the dog, did something that resulted in this being added. In a lot of situations, you, the dog, can do something that results in that being removed and unpleasant getting removed, which is also reinforcing and rewarding for a lot of dogs. So teaching them that they're in control of what they get and don't get is really important. And that's an important life skill, so that you don't have dogs just doing what they want when they want. Their decisions and their behaviors have consequences. It's how we live our life. So I think for me, a lot of it is just being able to explain how we live in life and how our children live in life. And you don't just want kids or humans doing what they want when they want. Everything that we do has consequences to them. Once a dog understands that they're in control, it's a little bit easier for us to kind of replicate nature's consequences, if you will, because a lot of nature's consequences are far more harsh than we would be, because we all love our dogs. We're not trying to kind of hurt or be unfair to our dogs. But if we did nothing and we allowed life to kind of lay that consequence down, whether it's a dog biting your dog or getting hit by a car or whatever, or getting bit by a snake, it's going to be far more harsh than us. So if I can replicate and get a point across in a much more fair way, I'm going to utilize these tools to my advantage to not only stop behaviors, but also reinforce behaviors and reinforce a dog making better decisions and making better life decisions, because they control what they get and what they don't get. So I hope that kind of answers the question. For me, it's just a matter of articulating, explaining the tools, and then getting them to understand the what we're trying to accomplish with training, so that a dog can mature into making better decisions on their own.
Yeah, no, I think that's great, man. I think that's great. It's perfect. Okay, so we've got just a couple minutes here. Like I said, we started a couple minutes late. I want to end with this question, and it's, like I said, a bit of a heavy one, but to really kind of shift gears. Shauna is asking, you know, what are some things that you consider or look at when behavioral euthanasia is in question? So, you know, some of these cases where it could be a dog that you've already worked with, it could be a dog you haven't worked with yet, it could be a rescue group. I know for me, these things don't come up that frequently, but it's a tough discussion for a lot of people.
So the first thing that I'm going to say is exactly what Tyler just said. It's a situation that occurs far less than, I feel like it's overdiagnosed with some people and some groups, or, you know, some training beliefs and stuff. I don't find myself in that situation often at all. But in the event that I think that maybe this is something that we need to consider, is we have to really look at quality of life. We have to look at quality of life, not only for the human, but especially for the dog, and what is the alternative? You know, like, you can look at genetics, you can look at certain things and go, okay, this dog is really in a tough spot, but what is the alternative if we don't do something like this? And can the humans be safe? Or is this dog going to continue to live, but live a really crappy life in a situation where it doesn't have a foster, it doesn't have a human, it's living in just, you know, poor conditions and the quality of life just sucks? It's like, then you start looking at this situation, because maybe it's too difficult of a case for someone to take on. You can't find an ideal person for this, for this trainer, the budget and the money in order to do this properly. There's just so many things to consider, but it's always going to boil down to like quality of life and the alternative. And we have to make sure that when we look at the alternative, we can keep people and other animals like safe. And when you find yourself in a situation where the alternative is other things, other people getting hurt, that's where that decision starts to become a topic that enters the discussion, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I think you touched on something kind of important. I mean, first of all, I would just say, like, for me, and I know this is probably the same for you, because you do a lot of, you know, dog on dog socialization, but for me, behavioral euthanasia is almost never a question when we're just talking about dog aggression. So, yep. You know, aggression towards other dogs or other animals. Like, that's almost never really something that I think about in there. But when we're talking about human aggression, and if it is really serious cases, it does come up at a time. But the distinction that you made that I just want to touch on for everybody listening is, there is a massive difference between sort of the standard or where the bar is set. If it's a family that brings a dog to me and the dog has a little bit of a bite history or is showing some human aggression and it's, you know, relatively serious, but the family's fully committed and they're prepared to do the things to sort of manage the environment and keep things safe, that's one situation. It's a totally different situation if a rescue organization comes to me and they've got that same exact dog with the same history and same set of behaviors, but there isn't already a committed family in place. And it's one thing to get an existing family and a dog to the point where they understand each other and they've got a strategy that works and things are kind of under control and managed. But again, it has a lot to do with the relationship that we've built between the two of them, versus taking that same dog and the bar is set such that we've got to get that dog to the point where we could essentially hand them off to a stranger, a totally new person that hasn't had all this coaching, and hope that it's going to go well. And of course, the counter argument is, well, what if you provide the coaching for the new adopted family? And I will say that anybody in this industry knows that on paper, when people are trying to adopt a dog, They are all about, oh yeah, I'll do what it takes. I'll put the time in. And as soon as they get that dog, things change. And it's just not a risk that we can often take, because people get the dog and they go, oh, you know, I think I can handle this on my own. I don't need the help from the trainer. Or they do one session with the trainer and they think they've got it all, and they don't show up for the final sessions. And then next thing you know, the dog bit the neighbor's kid and put the kid in the hospital. And now that kid's deathly afraid of dogs for the rest of its life. And a lot of times that's just not a gamble that I'm willing to take. So, you know, again, it's a very different discussion when it's a dog with a family and they're committed to each other and we're trying to make that work versus a rescue situation. And I know that's tough to hear. And I know a lot of people are all about like this sort of no kill. And we have to understand no kill means we don't kill any dogs that are reasonably adoptable. And we have to understand there are some dogs that just aren't really adoptable. It's not that that dog wouldn't be possible to fix in a different situation, but it's just not, there's no way we can hand that dog off to somebody safely and sort of hope for the best. And those are really tricky. And just the only other thing that I would add in for me is it becomes a very different discussion too when there's young kids in the house. That also, if there's a seriously aggressive dog and young children in the house, even if the dog's cool with those children, at some point as those kids grow up, they're going to have friends coming to visit a lot. There's just going to be a lot of chaos around, and this becomes a very, very different discussion. So that's another major factor that plays into things for me beyond the things that you already articulated. So anything else you wanted to add to that, Blake?
No, I think you touched on it perfectly. It's a tough topic overall.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think we hit some important points.
Cool. All right. So we're going to wrap things up there. Just thanks again, everybody, for joining us. Thanks for asking these great questions. Thank you so much, Blake, for being here. It's good to
thanks for having me. This
see,
is
your, see your pretty face again. And we'll have to do this again sometime soon. And you know, again, for you guys watching, we'll be back at this again the third Thursday of the month. I don't have that date in front of me right now, but actually can pull it up. Let's see here. That is the 17th at 3:00. We'll be back here again. And until then, you know, be sure to ask your questions on the Facebook group and we'll be keeping up with you guys. All right.
Awesome.
Thanks, everybody.
Awesome. Great. All right, guys.
That's all for today, folks. Be sure to tune in next time when Evan Doggett will be joining us from the Canadian North. We always have fun when Evan is here. Don't miss it.